I was overseas in Hong Kong with the rest of the boys. That's what he typed on it. Things weren't very rosy. Happened to survive through it. Lucky to be home.
Tell me, Mr. Cameron, how'd you get to Winnipeg? Were you born in Winnipeg?
No.
No.
Bertle,
oh, you're from Bertle, eh?
Bertle.
Yeah, okay. And your family, I suppose, homestead in Bertle, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where from, Scotland? No, yeah, that, no, just turn it towards you.
Yes. A native of Scotland, so where we are today.
And what type of work did you do before you started?
Farming. I was working on the farm and also operated a farm of my dad's for quite a number of years. Things get pretty tough in the hungry 30s. And got married. Wasn't much a fella could get anywhere, so I enlisted.
Were you living in Winnipeg when you enlisted? No. You came from the country, yes?
Yeah, I still came from Berlin, Winnipeg, and enlisted here. Short time. I was sent to Sherbrooke, Quebec for about 3 or 4 months. Come back and we were transferred to Jamaica.
What did you take in Sherbrooke, Quebec? Basic training?
Yeah.
So you only had about 3 or 4 months training altogether?
There.
There.
Went to Jamaica. We were guarding prisoners in Jamaica for quite a while. Then we come back. What are your intentions of going to Nanaimo to recuperate for about 4 months? Instead of that, we were home 2 weeks and they gave us word we had to pack up and go on someplace, didn't say where. We were under the opinion that we were still going to Nanaimo. Instead of that, we landed in Hong Kong.
And what were you supposed to do? Did you say recuperate? Were you not well, or is it just for...
No, it was through the climate.
Oh, yes, I see.
We got Jamaica in a very hot climate.
Oh, I see.
And to recuperate, to go into another cooler climate, if we had to go, you understand?
Oh, so they were trying to condition you.
Yes.
Good, yeah.
But something reappeared to the fact that because we were in Jamaica in a hot climate, they thought that we were able to stand Hong Kong, which is a warm climate too.
But when you left Jamaica, you had no idea you were going to Hong Kong?
No.
Did you have any rank in the Army?
No, just a private.
Just a private?
Yeah.
So then you got into a boat?
Yeah, we spent 22 days going to Hong Kong from Vancouver.
You did?
Yes. And it was quite a place to walk into when we did. But we were there for about, we landed there on the 16th of November, 1941. And war broke out on the 8th of December. So therefore we fought with all we had for 18 days before Hong Kong surrendered.
Did you feel that you had enough training?
Yes.
You were pretty well trained.
The training was all right. We had all kinds of ammunition, guns and that. We But we had no overhead, which is there for us.
Nothing at all.
Nothing. All there was is free planes in Jamaica, and we landed there, and they were airmail planes.
Hong
and
Kong,
in Hong Kong, yes.
Yeah. So where were you fighting? Where were you the day the attack? Where were you stationed at that time?
In Kowloon, which is there's a bay of water coming through, separating Hong Kong and Kowloon, and our base was in Kowloon. So we had to pack up and get across the bay of water to the Hong Kong island to be prepared for the attack of the Japanese.
So everybody was in a state of shock.
Yes, yes. The thought of the high command was that the Japanese would come in by boat through the bay, you know, to make the attack. Instead of that, they marched from what the heck's the name of that place?
The mainland.
Yes, they come across on the mainland, so therefore we were taken some by surprise, but we got time to get across anyway.
And how many days did you actually fight yourself?
18 days.
18, were you hurt?
Not then.
You weren't wounded or?
No, I wasn't wounded.
Very good then. And then what happened?
Well, we spent a year and a half in Hong Kong, and then they started taking the prisoners out of Hong Kong and taking to Japan in different places to work, which is well, 500 or 600 at the time. Some went to salt mines, some went to copper mines, some went to coal mines, dock work, dockyard, which was in different places. So for this reason, they took their own man out, put him in a battlefield, and put us prisoners to work.
What was the conditions in the Hong Kong prison war camp? Was the food bad?
To start with, we had enough of our own Canadian rations, or British ration, whatever you like to call it, that lasted about 3 months. After that, the Japanese gave us barley to eat, which was no food value.
Nothing in it?
No, just like the beer, you know, you use barley to make beer out of it, but just water. And I spent a year and a half there, and then I was taken over to Japan to go to work there. And while I was there, I was sort of pushed off a trestle, which is about 18 feet high off the ground, and I fell and I broke my right knee.
Well, what were you working in?
Coal mine. We were moving coal in a sort of like a hand car we use on the track here. You've seen people pumping these.
Like a jigger.
Like a jigger, you know, but it had a box on it that would hold at least pretty close on a ton of coal. 1,000 pounds of coal anyway in this box. Then you had to push this box around probably a quarter or half a mile to a different spot to dump it in a different place, because it come out of the boat, you know. And you dump it there, then you come around again, got your turn, filled it up the way you went again. And the worst part was we had to stick our shoes off, and we had to walk barefooted.
Why'd they do that?
I thought we would escape, you see. Now, on this catwalk, which is, well, your track is up about 18 feet high, you know, around, there's only two or three boards to walk on. Now, the bits of coal will drop down these boards, and they're sharp at any time. I don't know if you ever walked on coal or not, but so we cut our feet pretty bad, and we're blistered and infected and everything else. And so then they give us what they call a straw boot made out of straw. But they would only last about a couple of days walking on this coal and everything. And we didn't have any, had to go barefooted again.
What was the food and the conditions like in Japan, in your camp?
Why don't you tell them how long it took the coal to last?
No, the food is no different in Japan than it were in Hong Kong. We just received barley to eat three times a day, 7 days a week, 4 weeks in a month, 12 months in a year, about 4 years. So.
How did you take the boat trip? How did you get to Hong Kong?
Well, we were 22 days from Hong Kong to Japan, although we were quarantined for 2 weeks before we were taken off the boat after we had landed in Shamshipo, which is practically the northeast part of Japan. At least I surmise that anyway, and at least I figure that.
And what were they in quarantine for? The tropical disease?
yes. Various things, dysentery and diphtheria, and some typhoid fever, and all kinds of different diseases.
And where were you transported? Were you in the hold of the boat? Were you all piled in there?
Yes, we were. We were down in the right down to the bottom. We were sitting there like a bunch of flies on the post. You just sit down and pull your legs up, and the other fellow sat back to you, and there was no room to walk.
How about bathrooms?
I didn't see any.
They have a pail for you guys?
Yes.
You had a pail?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But,
did they allow you up on deck at all to walk or anything?
The odd time, if the night was dark, we could get up for a while in the night, but we could not get out in daytime. Wouldn't let it out in daytime.
And on that boat, there were Japanese sailors, I suppose.
Oh yes, it was all controlled by Japanese. It was a Japanese boat.
Was it a military boat or was it a cargo boat?
Well, I guess it was a cargo boat.
Did they treat you pretty well, the sailors on board? Or they didn't bother you?
No, they didn't. It wasn't them, it was the army personnel, the Japanese army, which was looking after them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we just received the same thing. We just received the barley. That's all we had at any time. There was nothing else. They couldn't get anything else. If they could, well, they didn't give it to us anyway. But we spent, as I said, we spent 22 days on the boat from...
I suppose when you got out in the sunshine, your eyes just about...
Yes, dearie. It was nice to get out of that hole. We lost a lot of weight due to perspiration. We had no clothes on while we were in the boat, except in the G-string, which cover your bit of privacy, and that's all. But it was so hot, everybody perspired so much that, at least I was there, at least in a couple of inches of water on the bottom of the deck, from perspiration.
Now, how much did you weigh when you were captured?
About 170,
175. And I suppose by the time you got to Japan, you had already lost quite a bit of weight.
Yes, we did. Then when I got hurt, they put a cast on me, and I laid on my back for a whole year in this cast. Couldn't get up.
And did they take the cast off?
No, I had to take it off myself. Mm-hmm. Due to the fact of, well, at least in avoiding anything, I got lousy and
yes.
Same as everyone else, and it began to bother me so much that I couldn't stand it anymore, and they, between it and the sand flies, they pretty drove me crazy, so I was pretty weak at the time. I had to the gas come up, and I was also banded around here, around the waist. I had to cut this band off of here, get it off before I could try sitting up. It took me quite a while, about a month, before I could sit up properly. And then I started working on this leg and started cutting the cast myself. Oh, I don't know how long, it took me 2 weeks or something to cut this cast.
And you would be so weak in the face.
Yes, and I could only cut a little bit at a time, and of course, there's no strength. So I finally got it off, I got it cut, and then I got the boy to help pull it apart, and he got my leg out, and but the knee never knitted. So
did your own who fixed your knee? Was it their medical?
Yeah, Japanese doctor.
A Japanese doctor.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And did you ever see him again, or did he just put the cast on? That was the last you ever saw him?
That's the last I saw him.
He never came to see if it knitted or anything. And when you broke your leg, did you think if he'd had the proper nourishment, he would have set your leg right?
No.
No, he didn't even do it right.
No. My leg was not set at the proper angle when they first put the cast on it. Normally, when they put a cast on a knee or something, they generally raise the knee a little higher than they level up the leg.
Like a little V.
Yeah, so it would be mm-hmm. up. Mm-hmm. Instead of this, with me, my knee was down about 4 inches below the level of the leg.
So your knee was going backwards?
Yes. So, when they brought me home and put me in bed, they had to put a box 18 inches high for my foot to be on so I could lay down. Due to the fact that the cast was around my body, and therefore it was all one piece. So instead of the knee being this way, it was this way. So when I lay down, this is the difference for my foot to sitting up on. Then when I did, when they got me up, weighed me, I weighed 76 pounds.
What in heaven's name did you feel you did to keep your sanity? What was it? Did you play word games with yourself, or were you in sort of a fog all the time? What do you find that sort of kept you going, besides the desire to live?
And away from family.
Well, there were a lot of things went through in my mind, but the more you're worried about it, the more the worse you got yourself into, like spiritually. So there was a few of them around, a few of them sick in there, so they could always talk back and forth to somebody while they was in there. And there was all some freshmen coming in from different sickness or broken legs or something. So there's always somebody to talk to and sort of pass the day away. And once the night come, about 9 o'clock, the lights was all out and the fire was out, and you just had to be quiet and sleep all night till next morning. And just started from day to day, and this is the way it was. The person couldn't put their mind on something and stay with it. Like to escape, or how am I going to get out of here? Just waiting on the good Lord's day to come, and it's just the way it was.
If you were laying in the hospital bed there, did they have an orderly like the young man was orderly to you guys?
Yes, we had some of our own boys give us aspirin for every ache and pain or disease what you had.
So they really, and I suppose the fellows really sort of stuck up for one another always.
Well, they did. There was no place they could go, and there was nothing else they could do. And if you need a little help, they all was there to help you. And we had water to drink, and as far as rations, the survival rations, there was nothing except barley.
How were the guards over there?
Japanese guard.
Yeah.
Well, the guards themselves are all right, but the head of the personnel, which was the sergeant and that, and the officers, they were very, very brutal. But if somebody stole anything or anything like that, the officer in charge would call you over and he'd start beating you up. And then the sergeant in charge of the guard, he'd beat you up. And then the 11 men guard would beat you up, so you'd get beat up about 12 or 13 men.
What'd they use?
Well, they used the palm of their hand.
Mm-hmm.
They would slap you on one side of the face and then turn and come back with the back of the hand and slap you on the other side. They did that for a few times, and as you're standing at attention, you're not too hard to be knocked over. Then when you did fall, they would kick you and kick you till you get up. When one man was finished with you, the other one started and did the same thing all over again. So, as I say, when you go through about 12 or 13 men with the same procedures, you don't feel very happy. And sometimes you can hardly move. And they figure you're just about the dead spell, and they leave you. A lot of times they use bamboo poles and I would say 2 or 3 inches, at least 3 inches in diameter. Sometimes they beat you with that, and it's all broken to slivers. So the officers themselves, they've got a long chain on their sword, and I guess a lot of people seen it. They take that off and make a person strip naked and beat them with that chain. So there are lots of things that they do, and they got no mercy on anybody.
They couldn't care. In other words, you fellows were a nuisance to them.
We were, yes. Yeah, they told us they didn't have to keep us, they didn't have to feed us. When they took us prisoner, they said that we could shoot them all down, shoot you all down. We said, we don't have to keep you at all. We don't have to feed you. But this is just my thinking, which is something happened in the ways between Japanese and German, which was decided on that they weren't going to take any prisoner. Then all at once, when Germany was defeated and taken over England and that, I think their role changed, and the Japanese had to go on their own, and therefore they found out they had to take prisoners and look after them, otherwise it might have been too bad for them.
Did you ever remember anybody from Geneva Convention coming?
No.
Nobody ever came to see you?
Well, no. There wasn't.
Did you ever get mail before now? Any letter?
I didn't get a letter.
Not a letter.
No. Quite a few of the people, or the people actually, the boys, got mail. Quite a lot of them got quite a few letters. But the one that didn't get any mail, that was all left in Manila. Now, I wasn't there, didn't see it, but I've heard from some of the boys that came back that there was a building there, quite a sized building, and it was just full of all kinds of mail and parcels, which, well, the parcels could be anything. It could be clothing, could be food, could be cigarettes, could be of all descriptions. So they just took and threw them in there, and this old building, and the roof was rotten in it, and it leaked on it, and the biggest part of the stuff rotted.
Did you ever have a chance to write one?
Oh, yes, I wrote every month.
I've got three letters.
And your wife got, all together, how many letters did your wife receive?
Three.
She said three, and that was the end of the war, yeah. At the end. The first 3.5 years, she never got anything from me. Never got a word at all. So, it was a tough battle all the way through. You had to learn to speak Japanese because he didn't speak anything else except Japanese.
You had to count right away. You had to say your number in Japanese, didn't you?
Oh yes, we were taken out on roll call night and morning. Everybody had to line up. If anybody was sick, they had to account for them. And we had a few boys that escaped. So therefore, we were held out on the parade for about 2 hours until they more or less found out where they were or what happened to them, and then they released us. But I think these boys were picked up somewhere in the water and brought back and shot down. That's what I understand.
How did those boys escape? Any idea how they got out?
Yes, I was told how they got out. But, mm-hmm. Well, we were behind about a 9-foot electric fence. But a fence came to a building from one side and stopped there, and then began on the other side of the building. So these boys figured it was a good way of getting out, so they got over top of the building and got out that way. They scrounged a little money from somewhere and scrounged a few guns or revolver, whatever it was, and some food, and they got a hold of a boat and they went out. But I don't know how far they got out on the water, but they were going, and they were, of course, when they fly over an airplane, don't take long to go over 100, 200, 300, 400 miles in no time. And they were picked up in short time anyway.
I got, well, one woman, her two sons escaped, and they were shot down. And she came to see us, and she asked him what happened to her boy, but he wouldn't tell her.
These guys escaped. Do you think that they bribed somebody to get those boats and things? They must have had some help somewhere.
Yes, I would say so, due to the fact that everybody was guarded pretty closely by the Japanese guard, so you didn't get much chance to get out. So somebody was working around them and got this boat and stole some gasoline and different kind of many gallons, I don't know, and got everything prepared to do this.
I guess, what did they use, watches and things like that for bribery? Watches, the you fellas' watches, what did you have to use those for bribery? And how did some of these guys get bribery? Where did they get the money, or have you any idea?
Oh, some of them some of the boys had quite a little bit of money. And the few of them, they were, would bring in some stuff, you know, to steal some stuff like sugar or milk, powdered milk, you know. And they made belts out of cloth and put it around their body inside their clothes and I've seen, and I'd get a few cans of milk someplace and put it in his belt and then come home and sell it for somebody. If he had a little money once in a while, he bought it, and if he didn't, why, he traded it for food and watches. Well, everybody traded their watches off for cigarettes with the Japanese in order to get smokes, because cigarettes, I should say, was a big factor in our living over there. A big factor. I know that I didn't have any cigarettes for 2 or 3 weeks, and when somebody come in with a few cigarettes and asked if somebody wanted some food for 2 or 3 cigarettes, so I traded them. And I know that I smoked a half a cigarette and I went to sleep and I slept for 5 hours and never woke up. So it must have helped. But there's quite a lot. There's about 260 boys taken out every day, you know, to go to work on the airfield. The Japanese used to give them 2 or 3 cigarettes apiece. You know, go to work, I guess, I don't know. So the boys that didn't smoke, they had cigarettes to trade off for food. But I traded off 2/3 of my food for a cigarette.
Where did you get? Did you ever get a Red Cross parcel?
Yes, we did.
But how often did you get one?
Oh. About once in 6 months or something like that.
One little Red Cross parcel.
It used to vary. It used to vary. Sometimes we would get a box amongst three, sometimes a box amongst two. But we've got a box amongst six. So there wasn't very many. But then when the food boxes did come in, the Japanese held them for at least 6 months before they gave them out. And I know that a few times there that we did get a box apiece. Accumulated, you know, but not very often. Mostly a box amongst three, amongst four, sometimes more than that.
Were you well enough to play cards or anything like that?
Oh, yes. After I got up off my back, I was able to sit up and in the tried getting up. Fixed a board to tie on the back of my leg, and I was walking around. Some, you know, not too much, but some.
The fellows who worked in the coal mines and worked for the military, did they get anything extra for their work? Like, did they get extra rations or anything at all?
No.
No, so they could, and most of them must have could hardly do a day's work.
Well, the only thing was that they were out every day, and The only way they got extra rations was from the ones that was in barracks that couldn't go out. And they'd give them little extra rations, but at the same token, the extra rations didn't help a great deal because there was no food value in it.
Did you get those diseases like beriberi or anything like that?
Yes. I had hot feet.
What's that?
Well, that's I don't know how, just exactly how to explain to you, but anyway, I would say like this, that you with the beriberi, you could go to sleep normally as I am now, and tomorrow you could wake up and you couldn't see out of your eyes, you'd all swell up with water, you know, literally. Your hands would be three times as big.
Your feet the same?
So your feet would be the same, but they would get hot in the sole of your feet. Now, we have one lad here now, if he's living, I don't know. But he still can't walk on the sole of his foot. He just walks on nice heels. He can't put any pressure on the sole of his foot because it's too tender. So disease, which my nutrition affected different people in different ways. First, with the body, we know that everybody has got a burnt out stomach and nothing else. Anybody that come back here and try to say, I'm a hero, I'm back home here, you know, and I can do this and I can do that, and drink and everything else, they just dumped themselves to death, some of them. I didn't drink very much. I know my stomach couldn't take it, and it don't yet, as far as that goes. Sure, I can take a couple of drinks of whiskey or even a couple of bottles of beer, but leave it at that. So, as I say, that quite a lot of them, they pretty near drank themselves to death because they figured they could, you know, survive, but they didn't.
When you came back, how were you mustered out? Tell me about the day you were released. You know, what happened that day you realized you were free?
We were there, when the word came that the war was over, the Americans started flying over, and they dropped a bag with some medicine and a few notes in it, asking us to give them a code on the side of the wall someplace on the mountain so they could read it. Ask them what we would like best. See? All right, so the officers did, and they flew over and read this code, so therefore in the next day or two we started receiving all kinds of heavy rations, which I would say was all canned ham and vegan, cocoa and tea and cigarettes and medical supplies, which, you know, but we were rationed at that because when they dare feed us too heavy, but if they did, that could kill us. So we were rationed there for. So we were there for a month or 6 weeks, I guess.
Who's in charge of the camp then? Americans?
There's nobody.
Nobody. And you just stayed there.
Yes, they lapped the guard. Japanese officials, high officials, they lapped the guard, which is 12 men to keep the rest of the Japanese from coming in on us, you know, and attacking us maybe brutally and that. But anyway, we broke camp, and everybody went out to different places, and they would get a chicken somewhere or get a few eggs or some potatoes and something, so anybody that had a few cigarettes, traded them off, or at least a watch maybe, and traded off to the Japanese for a different kind of food, and with the Americans giving us their supply, which helped us along, so. Then we were taken out of there by bus and by train and taken to segregation point. Oh. And then we were put on a boat there, and I was a casualty, so they kept me there and then flew me home. But the ones that were able to walk and all that, they took them to Manila and kept them there for another month or 6 weeks to right there and get them in a little better shape, and then some of them didn't come home for 3-4 months before they actually come home. They were kept in Vancouver for a while too.
I bet the longest day of your life is when you were waiting in to come home.
Well, I guess it wouldn't matter a heck of a lot then either, because you were just going, and of course we were in Guam and in Manila, No, we weren't in Manila. We were in Guam and Johnson, Kwajalein, and we were flown right across to supposed to get off of San Francisco, and we couldn't land there, so we had to go another 100 miles or something to put it in any base. They stopped there, and they got down there, and then we were brought back by cars to San Francisco, and we were there for about a day and a half, I guess, and we were put on a train and sent to Vancouver. I was in Vancouver for about, I don't know, a week or 10 days, something. You know, going through different medicals and clothing and the one thing and other, and got a little money out of it, and they gave us a ticket home and ration food, coupons to eat on the train. So I was home for about a month or something like that, and then I was called back to barracks, and then I was, the first year I was sort of home for 2 weeks, and 2 weeks in Deer Lodge, and just the way it went for nearly all the year. And then I think it was on the 12th of December 1946 that they operated on his knee, and they fused it. They cut 2 inches out of the knee, which was no good. And they fused it, and I was about 16, 17 months before I was able to get a job. And then, work wasn't very plentiful, and wages wasn't very much either, and I worked a bit in the summer. In the wintertime, I collected unemployment insurance. And in 49, I believe it was November, I lived in Tindall, Manitoba then. I went to the store and got a few groceries, and I was walking home. I walked across the street like over there, and I was walking home, and a car was driven by a man that was pretty well intoxicated, and he didn't see me. I guess it was over my leg and broke it.
The same leg?
Same leg. So I was another 14, 15 months of that before I was able to go back to work. 1952, I took a job as wherever salesman. I wasn't doing too bad. Shoal Lake, Manitoba, which I landed about midnight. I was going to get some gasoline, and I was in a hurry to catch the guy before he left the garage, and I raised his foot up and got up on his side, and my right butt hadn't left it high enough. And I hit the cement, and she just broke right off. Well, I got a while with that again before I get back. So in November 1953, I got a job with a Winnipeg Flying Club. So I spent pretty near 17 years there.
What were you doing there?
Oh, I did everything in there, from soup to nuts.
Jack
of all trades. Yes, I did everything. I cleaned the floor, and I waxed the floor, and I scrubbed them, and they set up tables, and handled dishes, and made breakfast, and handled the bar, and, you know, and orders of different kinds, and all kinds of work.
When you were in camp, is there any incident that happened that stood out in your mind, something that happened in camp? Was there any special guard or anything that you disliked, or was there any incident that you think of?
Anything that sort of a cruel or brutal or something?
Anything at all you remember it.
Oh, yes. The officials, the Japanese officials, which would be a sergeant or an officer, when he came into the camp and everybody had to get up and stand at attention quick and salute him, and if you didn't salute him, he'd be right back and slap you down, see. And this happened quite a lot in the camps at night. Each guy used to beat guy, you know, her fellow man pretty bad. And as I said before, the Japanese officers were walking out in the anywhere outside the building, and if you didn't salute him, suppose you were a quarter of a mile away from him, he'd walk over to you and say, "Well, why didn't you salute me?" And right away he'd beat you up. So they would also change officers about every 3 or 4 months, and there'd be a new man come in, and therefore we'd take it out on parade and lined up, and he would give it as a speech, you know. Of course, it was in Japanese and then transferred, and they had an interpreter telling us what he wanted and what we're supposed to do and what we weren't supposed to do. Did anybody try to escape, he would be shot right on the spot. And no stealing, and everybody had to abide by what they said. And so these things that I do know we had quite a lot of those kind of very brutal. We had one fellow which is from Kamloops, and he was a Japanese sergeant, and he beat Dr. Crawford up.
And he was a Canadian?
Well,
he was from Kamloops.
Yeah.
So he was a Japanese?
Yeah, because he had he had good schooling, what you might say, and good education, and because he was here and he could speak English, and they took him in there and made him an interpreter, you see. And also, well, they made him a sergeant, and then he could interpret what... interpreter, you see. And also, well, they made him a sergeant, and then he could interpret what they said and in turn tell us without getting an extra man, you see.
Well, was this guy from out of your own services, or was he from Japanese
army? He was a Japanese.
And he was in the Japanese army, but he had come from, he was somehow rather after, he was in
Kamloops.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's where he's home, and this is what I mean. Now,
what did you beat Dr. Crawford up?
Well, this could be a long story. It could be a short one. I don't think that Dr. Crawford actually meant wrong, but whatever he said to him, he didn't like it. And he was a big man. He was well of 6 feet. This year, fellow from Canada. So he weighed about 180, 85 pounds. So he was a big man, and he just threw his weight around as he liked. So whatever happened between him and Crawford, which he didn't like what Crawford said, or he asked for something and he didn't want to give it him, what, and anyway he started beating Dr. Crawford up. And of course, you dare fight back, you just had to sit stand there or lay there and take it, because when that guy had got a sword or a rifle, a fixed bayonet standing beside you, a loaded rifle, what can you do? You got no chance, but whatever. Nobody had a chance. You just had to take and do and live with whatever they say.
Did they put any other means of torture with the guys in bad torture?
Yes, they did, Americans.
They're mean to Americans.
Oh, they were. I know of two, which I believe there was three, but I know of two. They shot down these two Americans, and they took the pilot, they stripped them, and they tied their hands together, and their feet together. Now they used a long pole, I'd say about 10 or 12 feet long. They thread it through the arms here, also through the feet. And they tied it up to the trees, the pole, when you were hanging there. And they used torches, and the torches, they would divert all the flesh off these men.
And did you guys see it?
I seen one.
No, but did you see them torturing them, or what?
I seen one.
Did they bring you guys out to see this?
Well, they just did it. They don't have no hiding places. No. They don't have anything like we have. Why I say this is, when they dealt with us the same as they did with their own men. Now, if a man was out all night and he didn't come back, and he did come back sometime 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, he came right up to wherever he was supposed to be, and he wasn't taken into no office and questioned him, and he just beat him up right there.
And that would be their own men?
Yeah, their own men.
So they're very cruel to their own?
Oh, yes, as I said, they dealt with us the same day to their own men. They just beat their own man up right there, and he had to take it all over to it. So they dealt the same way with us, and they tortured these Americans pretty bad. And one died, I know that one died, and the other survived, but I don't know how he did.
Somebody told me that they treated some of the fellows from India a little bit better. Do you have Indian soldiers there?
Oh, yes. We had two regiments of Indian soldiers in there. The Gurkhas and the... I think the Gurkhas is the ones that have their turban on hand, and then the others they were dressed in Canadian American or American clothes, and dressed like our men were. Mm-hmm. Then the other, oh yes, we had a couple of thousand in there.
How did they fare? Just the same as you?
Well, pretty well. But they didn't. Mixed with us very much. They stayed by themselves, and the Indians, you know.
Do you think they did better on the diet than you guys did?
No, they couldn't. They couldn't.
No. I just wondered if their body would be more accustomed to that type of thing.
No.
So they just were just as sick, probably weaker, right?
Well, I don't suppose they're any weaker. I don't think they were, because they had the same kind of food that we had, and there was nothing else coming in there any different than it was to us. But I'm pretty sure that nobody got any different food than them. Because they brought in a load of stuff, a truckload of stuff. There were so many bags dropped here, so many pounds of stuff, and then the rest went to another camp and to another kitchen, whatever it is. No, there was nothing different. So...
Did you feel that any of your guys in your camp were stool pigeons or anything like that?
What you mean by stool pigeon is that?
Well,
squawking?
Stool
pigeon. No.
Yes,
no, 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 no.
He collaborate with the
deaf. You're talking of two different people. You've got two different people mixed up in this.
Wouldn't that be a stool pigeon?
No, not. A stool pigeon is the guy that cooperated with the Japanese and didn't give us what we were supposed to get. All right, what you meant was the guy that worked in the kitchen. All right, the officers in Hong Kong, they got some meat, and they got their officers, and they had money, so they paid a little extra, and they got a little extra food. And what happened was, when they fried the meat, they did not save the grease to put on the barley, which had made a little bit of grease, you know, on it instead of just riot it was. They let the thing run out the darn drain and around the building. There's a cement trough all around, so it was there, and then the grease was piled up about so high that it was running out there, which well, I'd say half a gallon at least, and a half a gallon of grease over a lot of food would mean a little bit. Mm-hmm. This was the big dispute. Why did they do this? But by throwing it out, they didn't care. Then again, the stool pigeon, which is a different thing, isn't it? Stool pigeon, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well, we had to call him stool pigeon.
Stool pigeons were. We had a few of them. We had a few.
Seriously, yes. When they, any of those guys, did they get it? Nobody really got any better treatment than the other one. Did Dr. Crawford try and look after you guys the best he could?
Well, now look, as I said before, he had no.
Drugs, no?
We had a little bit in Hong Kong, but when we were taken to Japan, there was less. Now, as I said, that while we were in Hong Kong, we had some of our Canadian medical supplies, which was stored, and we carried away as much as we could, or on the trucks we were taking, you know, we were taking prisoner. And supplies were taken in or whatever we were putting there. So we had a little bit to carry for a while, but after we were transferred from there to Japan and different places in there, there were no doctors there of any kind. And there was nobody there. And then they finally got us some aspirin. So you got aspirin for every kind of sickness that you had, regardless of what it was.
Did you, how many guys do you think died in that camp? Have you a rough idea how many were in the camp?
Well, I'll tell you, I may be wrong, and I don't think I'm too far out. I had figured out in the battle, we lost about of our regiment. I thought we lost less than 300 men. So that would cut it down to about 900. Then we lost about, I don't know. We could have lost 150, 200 men in camp after we'd taken prisoner. So that had cut it down to about 700, roughly, you know, more or less. Then we've lost, I don't know how many.
How many came back? Do you remember
the question? Oh, that's a good question.
You don't know?
No, I don't.
We'll have to find that out.
How many came back? Actually, as I said, I spoke to you while I was on the phone there, and I said, I've tried to find out how many we have at present living, mm-hmm. And they're not able to tell me.
No, because they've scattered.
Well, they are. They're scattered all over.
Do you have any hang-ups about it? I mean, do you sometimes still have bad dreams about it, or is that worn out on you?
No, I give it up. A lot of people don't want to talk about it.
People are different.
I have been asked by the Veterans Association to go to out to to Hong Kong or to for sightseeing and that, and they said no. I said I had enough of it.
What was the name of your camp? That's what I want to ask you. And what was your family like? You were married at the time. How many children did you have?
Three.
What were their ages when you left here?
Ronnie wasn't going to
school. No, Ronnie was about five, and Joyce was about three.
Jimmy was six or eight months.
So.
And you came back, and there were strangers to you, right?
Well, pretty nearly.
Ronnie, Jimmy was a complete stranger.
Yeah.
He didn't know. Yeah, like I had a big picture. oven, and I had it sitting on a buffet. So I would keep telling her that was her dad. When he came home, he said to Jimmy, he said, "How did you know that I'm your dad?" Well, he said, "It's the same face that's in the picture."
That's good.
Yeah. But, you know, he wasn't used to it. He slept with me all the time.
Yeah.
And when he came home, we said, "Well, you'll have to sleep with Ronnie, you know." And every night, after my dad goes to bed and I go to sleep, he sneak in again beside me. He said, "What are you doing here?" I took a chance and got in.
Mr. Cameron, how's the pension? Are you on pension now?
Yes, 100%.
100%. Did you have any trouble with that?
Getting it? Or?
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. As time went along, on different occasions where I went in for, each time when I had a broken leg, when I fixed my leg first, it put me on a 60% pension right off the bat, you see, which would included about 30% on my leg and 30% on my body, which would include my stomach and, you know, and eyes and that. My eyes failed me quite a lot. Then when I broke my leg in 49, I got another 10% out of it, and then in 53, I got a little more, and then here about 3 years ago, I think, when they come out with two or three years, they come out with the readjustment of pensions for all veterans. So they give me 100%.
And your stomach has never been the same?
No, it never will be. Never will be.
And how about your eyesight? Was that?
Well, I get glasses and that, but it's never the same either. Of course, I can see, I can drive a car and that, but I was told by the by the optical
specialist
that my eyes are pinholed, the back of the eyes, which you can't see it. They can't see through what they light up on. And he said it was very. This is what he said that it caused my eyes to go up, because the eyeball is not completely closed at the eye, the back. He said it got pinholes in it.
Tell me, what education have you got?
Oh, I didn't have much. Six.
Grade 6 is how much?
Father died when he was 9 years old.
And how old are you?
69.